This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This advertisement feature is paid and presented by Go Türkiye. Türkiye is a golfer's paradise, and much of that is down to Belek on the country's southern Mediterranean coast. Courses here cut through lush pine forest, set on fast, sandy ground that's kept in immaculate condition all year round. And for those never quite ready to call it a day, Belek is also host to the first full 18-hole floodlit course in Europe. Local pro Dennis Sutmaz is lucky enough to call Belek her training ground.
There are more than 15 courses. You can play golf in winter and summer.
And once the round is done, long lunches replace scorecards and spas, hammams and slow afternoons take over.
When I'm not playing golf, I usually go to the beach, tan, go into the sea. You just feel like you're in another world.
Because in Belek, luxury isn't about excess. It's about time well spent. Plan your next detour at goturkiye.com today.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parris. So, if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
In this episode of The Briefing Room, I'll be asking how this hugely publicised police investigation lost its way to such a degree, and what lessons this holds for the future of inquiry into historical sexual abuse. Joining me here in the briefing room are Alison Levitt QC and David Tucker from the College of Policing.
Had he been a normal person, a normal member of the public, this would never even got as far as it did.
A senior policeman on the late Leon Britton.
4 years into this, nobody associated with Leon Britton has actually come forward, and there's been absolutely nothing come out of it whatsoever.
Leon Britton's wife, Diana.
What I'd really like is that what happened to me and Leon, to Lord Bramall, to Harvey Proctor and to others never happens to anyone else.
An investigation that destroyed reputations.
The evidence wasn't there, so Lord Britton deserved the same protection from the law as the normal man in the street.
Today, I'll be asking how this hugely publicised police investigation lost its way to such a degree, and what lessons this holds for the future of inquiry into historical sexual abuse. Joining me here in the briefing room this week are Alison Levitt QC and David Tucker from the College of Policing. But first, I'm joined by Panorama's Alistair Jackson. Alistair, you've been working on this subject for over 3 years. For Panorama, for the report here on Radio 4, and now for the briefing room. It's been quite a ride from Savile to here, isn't it?
Yeah, it really has. And take your mind back to that febrile atmosphere at the start, where there was an expectation almost that some of these allegations against VIPs would stand up. But in fact, there were some officers within the Met who were urging caution, and now we're going to hear from one of those.
You're still a serving Met officer. Why have you taken the decision to go public with your concerns about what's happened and what's happened to you?
I think it just needs to be brought into public.
This isn't without risk for you, though, is it, doing this?
Absolutely not. There is a significant risk attached to doing this.
And what would that be?
Potential discipline and potentially losing my job.
Detective Chief Inspector Paul Settle was the head of the Met's paedophile unit when all this started back in 2012. One of around 500 complaints he was asked to investigate was from a woman who was given the name Jane. She accused the former Home Secretary Leon Britton of raping her back in the late 60s. She'd been an adult at the time.
The investigation progressed remarkably well, given that it was some 47 years old. It was when I reviewed her second interview that I started to have concerns. And those were that what she said had happened didn't amount to a rape.
Now, this was key for Paul Settle. According to Jane's own account, the man she was accusing of rape, whoever he would not have known she was not consenting to sex.
From your point of view, what difficulty did that lead to in terms of interviewing the suspect, Leon Britton, the former Home Secretary?
Interviewing a suspect under caution is exercising a police power. And it was my opinion at that time that there weren't reasonable grounds to suspect that an offence had occurred. I'm by no means an expert on sexual offences, so I sought the opinion of the senior Crown Prosecutor for London that deals with sexual offences, and I send completely anonymised information pack to her with all the relevant details in, and she came back with the same opinion, that she wasn't satisfied that the offence of rape had been committed. Every decision I made was ratified by the Gold Group, which is a group which oversees the conduct of the investigation.
Ordinarily, that would have been that. But 7 months later, the Met reopened the case. By then, Labour's deputy leader, Tom Watson MP, had written to the Director of Public Prosecutions about the case. Paul Settle's decision had become controversial. It had been reported by some parts of the media. Senior Met officers decided they would review what he'd done. Paul Settle now believes this was the start of the end of his career.
When you were called in and told that your decision-making was being reviewed, what were you told about your position in these inquiries?
I was told to have nothing more to do with them, full stop, non-negotiable. And I was basically going into work and staring at the wall for 8 hours. I repeatedly asked to be given something to do and was told there was nothing for me to do and there was no job there. I was sent away for a month marking exam papers, and when I came back I was told there was still nothing for me to do. I carried on going into work for a couple of weeks until, quite frankly, I couldn't take any more of it, and I took 2 weeks holiday. Unfortunately, the 2 weeks holiday didn't do anything to help me, and after that I went sick. My health suffered considerably as a result of this, and I continued to be under doctor's treatment.
The new investigation came to exactly the same conclusion as Paul Settle had months before, but they had interviewed Leon Britton and his name had come out as a suspect. He died not knowing the case had been closed.
Could I call the committee to order and welcome DCI Settle? Thank you very much for coming in, DCI Settle, at such very short notice.
In Parliament, the Home Affairs Select Committee wanted answers.
I mean, in your professional opinion, which is significant, would you then say that what we had was a baseless witch hunt?
I think the interview was without grounds.
Again, it was Paul Settle's decision not to interview Leon Britton that was under scrutiny.
And over the passage of time, are you aware of any further piece of evidence that provided reasonable objective grounds based on known facts or information?
Nothing.
So what you're saying to us, when it was grossly disproportionate, it would not have a legal basis, effectively what you're saying to us is that the subsequent interview under caution of Lord Britton, in your opinion, was unlawful?
That's correct, sir, yes.
So you took the decision to give evidence to the Home Affairs Select Committee. Was that an easy decision to take, and what pressures were you put under about going before them?
It was a difficult decision to take. I was asked to give evidence. Initially, the Metropolitan Police said it was inappropriate for me to give evidence because of my junior status. When that didn't fly, they then phoned me up and asked me if they could use my medical condition as an excuse for me not to give evidence, saying I was unfit to give evidence, which I declined.
What was it like giving evidence on that day?
It was quite daunting having a deputy assistant commissioner and an assistant commissioner sat behind you throughout the whole time. I could feel their eyes burning into my back.
In the end, the committee said Paul Settle's conduct was exemplary, but the Met still ordered Dorset Police to review the case. The Dorset Constabulary's report went against Paul Settle. According to them, he'd been a junior officer who'd taken the wrong decision not to interview the former Home Secretary.
Right from the word go, you know, I could see that that was a hatchet job. I could see what the outcome was going to be. I dare say I could have written the outcome. They had failed to grasp that the evidence was not there.
Paul Settle had, if you like, stuck his neck out by taking a decision. He'd asked for advice from the Crown Prosecution Service, who'd agreed there was no evidence of an offence. But ultimately, it was his call to not interview Leon Britton or even tell him he'd been accused. What's clear now is that once he'd been removed, the Met went back time and again to the CPS to get them to make a decision on the case.
I think it's quite simple. The Met didn't want to make the brave decision. The Met wanted somebody else to do it so that they could stand there and go, well, we've done everything, it was the CPS that made the decision, not us.
Can you believe that the Commissioner, Sir Bernard Hogan Howe, had no involvement in how this played out?
He must have known what was going on. Certainly when I was running the show, there were regular written updates to the commissioner. So I can't imagine that that would have changed. And I would suggest that at its high point, it would probably be daily updates.
Now, spin forward to the last couple of weeks. An independent review has heavily criticised that process of trying to get the CPS to take responsibility for a decision that should have been the Met's own. Sir Richard Enriquez, who conducted the review, said that Lord Britton ended up being interviewed simply because of who he was, and Sir Richard vindicated Paul Settle.
He thought my conduct was exemplary and that I'd conducted myself very well.
Do you feel that that's enough now that Sir Richard Enriquez has come to this conclusion?
No, I don't. I think the taxpayers have got an experienced DCI that's got a long-standing history of dealing with sensitive matters and high-profile cases who's been hung out to dry. It's effectively seen my career disintegrate before my eyes, and there was absolutely no reason or justification for it.
And how do you think Leon Britton and his family were treated in this case?
I think they were treated absolutely atrociously, and the one thing that I would like to say is to apologise to Lady Britton and her family, because had I informed them at the time that I made a decision to take no further action, it would have been significantly harder for the police to reopen the case.
You were actually calculating that he would never need to know he'd been subject to this allegation.
Yeah, absolutely. My view was that he never need know that somebody had made a spurious allegation against him. I'd acutely aware that Lord Britton was ill, and the thought of me turning up on his doorstep and saying, by the way, you've been accused of rape, but don't worry, we've cleared you, would just add needless anxiety to him at an hour where, quite frankly, he had more important things to worry about.
He was lying in hospital. I went to see him one afternoon and he said, I've just been rung by the police.
Diana Britton, Lord Britton's widow, has never spoken publicly about the impact of the Met overturning Paul Settle's decision.
I said, what's it about? He said, I'm not terribly sure, but I've just said to them, I'll ring my lawyers. And then the lawyers rang me and then they said to me, this is a old rape allegation, 47 years old, against Leon.
What did you think at that point?
Well, I didn't know quite what to think. I couldn't possibly have believed it. I first met Leon in 1973. I just could not believe that this was him. It was not the man that I knew.
Can you just put into words how things progressed from that point?
Well, the next thing that happened was that he went to the lawyer's office when he came out of hospital, and then about a couple of weeks later, he was interviewed under caution in the office of the lawyer. Very short interview, no tape recorder. The police were extremely late at it. I wasn't present, of course. He was asked no supplementary questions at all. In fact, he was asked practically no questions. It was a very short interview. And at the end of it, he felt absolutely assured in his own mind that that would be the end of the matter.
The effect of him being interviewed was that his name became public. How did that evolve?
The name became public, I suppose, a week or two later. And I remember being rung up by the BBC on a Saturday night saying, this is all going public tomorrow. What could I say? He was not at all well. I mean, he, after all, had one huge operation, a number of weeks in intensive care, and then the second operation. But of course, the gate was absolutely besieged by press, and it was the first time, and not the only time, that I was chased by a car. Very, very frightening thing to be done in the Yorkshire lanes, and I had to try and find somewhere to go to where I couldn't be followed, which is what in the end, I threw them off. But for me, it was a very terrifying occurrence. Maybe he was used to that, but I don't think I was.
And at the time, how did your husband cope?
I think he kept it very much to himself, because his major objective during those last few months was to get better, get well, do everything that he could to get well.
And obviously, as events then played out, you realised that actually the police had known for some months that the investigation was going nowhere. When did you first realise that that had been the case?
I learnt, I think it must have been in July of the following year after he had died, from the Independent on Sunday, there was a press report that no further action would have been taken. I then got my lawyers to write to the police saying, was this story true? because they hadn't bothered to inform me. And I suppose about a month later, I got a reply.
Saying what?
We wouldn't have continued it, not enough evidence. Sorry, we've caused you distress.
And it had been how many months since your husband died at that point?
By that time, it had been the end of January to the middle of September.
What do you think about that now?
I think particularly for him, he should have known that he was innocent of the charges before he died, but that didn't happen.
What is now clear is that the original officer investigating the case didn't even want you to know that there'd been an investigation and didn't want your husband to know because he concluded there was nothing in it very early on. What kind of effect has that had on you, learning that information out?
Well, now I've learnt it, and now it has become clear that DCI Settle's original decision was the correct one, it's made me very saddened, because I realised that the last year or so, or the last year that Leon was alive, it would have been very different. I mean, there would have been many things that wouldn't have happened, all the things that I've described. It would have been an easier time for me and him, looking after him, having him home, away from hospital, and in the final few months. And so I think I've been immeasurably saddened and very much aware of the bravery of DCI Settle over appearing in front of the Select Committee for Home Affairs.
Yes. How do you think that the Met have handled all this, particularly given the fact they had a senior officer telling them there was no case?
Well, I suppose what I've always said is that it seemed to me during the course of this particular inquiry that Leon was worse treated than had he been an ordinary citizen. And that, I felt, was wrong. The presumption of innocence had been set aside.
How difficult has it been when you learnt of these allegations to not let it affect your belief in your husband?
I think that when you're in the eye of a storm, quite as turbulent as this storm, that it's very hard to keep your poise and your belief. And what I was much assisted by during all of this was my two daughters, and they would always say to me at the end of every conversation, "Mum, it's not true. Just remember that, it's not true." And it wasn't true.
That was Diana Britton talking to our reporter Alistair Jackson, who's still with us. We put the points which were raised in Alistair's report to the Metropolitan Police. They told us the Commissioner, Sir Bernard Hogan Howe, has personally and unreservedly apologised to Lady Britton and offered a further personal meeting should she wish. As far as DCI Settle's story is concerned, the Met says it has offered support to DCI Settle and still wants to help him in his career. The Met also reiterated that it has fully accepted the findings by Sir Richard Henriquez. He was commissioned by the police to review this case and others. His findings were highly critical of the police. Here with me also in the briefing room is Alison Levitt, QC, now a partner at Mishcon de Rea, but formerly the principal legal advisor to the Director of Public Prosecutions. As part of her role, she wrote the Crown Prosecution Service's in-depth review of their own investigations of allegations against the entertainer Jimmy Savile, and by David Tucker, who is the lead for crime and criminal justice for the College of Policing, which is the body set up in 2012 to improve policing standards. Alison Levitt, how did we get into this situation?
It appears that the police wanted, quite rightly, to learn the lessons from what had gone wrong in Savile, because one of the conclusions that I reached in my report was that there had been a degree of deference to Jimmy Savile because of who he was, who he knew, and the power he appeared to wield. The Metropolitan Police Service, I think, took from that 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 must never happen again, and nobody would disagree with that. What appears to have happened is a degree of what one might call oversteering in the other direction. For example, I was surprised and frankly bewildered to learn that the police now have a policy of saying that they believe all the victims, and that is their starting point for any investigation. That clearly can't be right and isn't sustainable, and it looks as though that is an overreaction to what happened in Savile.
David Tucker, should the police start from a position of believing the victim?
So the police position as set out by the College of Policing is that when an initial investigation or initial allegation is made, that the police will start from the position of believing the victim, that that is the thing that happened. And that is then followed by a gathering of evidence taken forward in a balanced way. The difficulty with starting from a position where you don't believe is that actually you tend to leak that scepticism or lack of belief, and that can cause people not to come forward.
To believe the allegation and take that as a starting point is wholly incompatible with the burden of proof in criminal trials in this country, and they appear to have rather lost sight of the fact that a criminal investigation is not about therapy, it's not about truth and reconciliation, it's about seeing whether enough evidence can be gathered to put a case in front of a jury. That is the test that is imposed by the Crown Prosecution Service, and it's the one I think that the police need to keep in the forefront of their mind, rather than thinking about the effect, or if you like, the social consequences of how they behave towards complainants in these cases.
I don't agree with you, Alison, about investigation being only to gather evidence. It's not. It is also to give support and to make sure that victims get the help that they need. And we use, you know, and the police will signpost people to get the support they need.
Well, I think that there is it seems to me a confusion here between two things. The first is about how you encourage people to come forward, and the second is what the purpose of a police force is, which is surely to investigate with a view to bringing cases to court.
It's not just about gathering the evidence. It's around getting the support. It's around making sure that people feel confident about coming forward. And the other point about this is that if we don't do that, people who have committed awful offences will get away with it. And that puts other people at danger. And so we have an interest as society in getting all of the information in, but there has to be a balanced and fair investigation, and maybe that hasn't happened in some cases.
We certainly don't disagree about it being balanced and fair. I mean, there's a real issue here with terminology to start off with. And this is, again, something that Sir Richard mentions in his report. The police consistently use the word victim from the outset of the investigation, whereas I think there can be absolutely no doubt that the proper expression is complainant, because at that stage it is only an allegation. Nobody becomes a victim until the defendant has been convicted in a court. That is in accordance with the burden of proof. The burden of proof is upon the prosecution to prove its case and make a jury sure. Until that point, the suspect remains innocent until proven guilty.
It does seem odd that you wouldn't just simply say, I neither believe nor disbelieve, I hear. What would be wrong with saying that? Why wouldn't people come forward if you were to say, that culture of disbelief we once used to have, we don't have that disbelief culture anymore, but we're not going to replace it with a culture of automatic belief, but we are listening to you. Why wouldn't you just say that?
Because you're trying to split what you with the way you behave with what's happening in your brain, and actually that's quite difficult to do. People leak their disbelief if they don't believe, or they leak their lack of support, or they leak their cynicism. So it's actually quite difficult to do. But the bigger point here is around the message, the leadership that the police service has given around the belief that we give to people when they come through the door to make an allegation. This is not a continuing belief. It is a belief that allows us to record the allegation at the first point, and then that allegation has to be tested.
But if what you're saying, David, is that an officer has to have the mental mindset of absolutely accepting as true what this person says from the minute they say it, the converse of that, obviously, is that they accept that the suspect is guilty without more on the basis of that allegation. How then, first of all, could any suspect believe that there can be a properly impartial investigation? And how, in fact, can there be an impartial investigation if you're saying it's so important that the officer has to actually believe the victim? Is it not there a real danger that when they're confronted with evidence that might tend to undermine that belief in the truth of the investigation, they fail to give it the weight it ought to get?
The evidence that we have that takes us to the position that we have is that if we follow the approach that we've had in the last 20 years, people don't come forward, and there are a lot would then be lots and lots of people, as there continue to be, who have allegations that are true that the police service simply doesn't know about, and there are lots of people out there who are getting away with pretty awful behaviour.
But it's not a binary choice, is it?
You are, it isn't.
It isn't a binary choice that the police start off with saying, I believe or I don't believe. They say, I've got an open mind. I hear what you say. I'm supportive and I'm sympathetic and I'm going to investigate it from the point of view of an open mind.
Are the police spending too much time, in the end, investigating historical cases at the expense of ongoing crime?
I think it's a really, really difficult question. The guidance from the College of Policing, based on evidence, would be focus first on safeguarding now, because that's clearly it's got to be the priority. But the reality is that we do have to look at these historical cases as well and make sure that where we can learn lessons or where we can protect the public today, that we learn those lessons and do the right things. Because, you know, I have a huge sympathy for Lady Britton and the situation that she found herself in. We need to make sure that if there are lessons to be learned here, we do that, and we get that from historical cases too.
And the observation that I'd want to make about it is this: nobody is trying to suggest that investigating these cases, whether they're non-recent or whether they're recent ones, is easy. They're immensely hard. But hard things don't become simple simply because you put a set of very rigid guidelines or principles in place. That doesn't make it easier. It just makes it more likely that things are going to go wrong.
So can we just go to this point about whether or not suspects should be anonymous up to the point of charging? It seemed to me that the police were confronted with a problem, particularly with historic child sexual abuse cases, which was the problem that there would be very likely no forensic corroboration. And that meant that if you were going to achieve and create a case, the way you were likely to do it was by getting as much other corroboration from other potential complainants or victims as you possibly could. And therefore, it was in your interest to try and find a way of getting the name out into the public domain so that other people could complain. Now, in some cases where the supposed perpetrator is not known, that may not be very problematic. But where you have a supposed perpetrator who is very well known, don't you have an obvious problem of contamination?
So the guidance that we give around that is very clear too, that the decisions to release the identity of individuals prior to charge has to be in exceptional circumstances only, and it has to be authorised by a chief officer. And clearly what you would have to consider very carefully the dangers of contamination. And so when deciding on what information you might put into the public domain, you would need to put in enough of a gist so that people knew what you were talking about, but not enough to be able, for people to be able to construct a story. And that is a very fine judgment to make.
Alison Levitt, what do you make of that?
Well, as far as the anonymity of suspects is concerned, I have come to the conclusion with a very heavy heart, I have to say, that I think the time has come where we need legislation to prevent the names of suspects being given, probably from the point that the allegation is first communicated to the police until the point where a charging decision is made. And the reason I say with a heavy heart is that I'm firmly of the view that we live in an open society, and frankly, secret justice, as it were, is the hallmark of dictatorships normally. But in these particular circumstances, the damage that appears to have been done to individuals, not just their reputations, but we have heard heart-wrenching accounts of the ruination of lives that could have been avoided if their names hadn't been released to the public, that we probably have come to the point where that has to be given really serious consideration.
Alison Levitt and David Tucker, thank you very much indeed. Alistair, 3 years on from starting your investigations into this, do you think we're getting close now to a position of equilibrium whereby we won't make the mistakes of the past of ignoring abuse or of creating injustices on unjustly accused people?
I think there has been a change. I think people now accept that you have to look closely before you form a judgment on things in the media, but particularly some of these cases have been aired with not much scrutiny. And it probably comes back to what David was saying earlier on, where the focus is on evidence. And I think both the police and the media have probably, in the light of all this, readjusted or reminded themselves of where that needs to be.
Well, evidence and analysis is what the briefing room is all about, and we'll be back to do a bit more of it next week. That's it for this episode of The Briefing Room. My thanks to Alastair Jackson, David Tucker and Alison Levitt. If you enjoyed this programme, you might also like a new BBC World Service podcast called The Compass. It's a series that looks at big ideas, issues and trends. Thanks for listening.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.